Do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
I can go first.
All right.
Just because I don't need to.
So today, my story is about Virginia Piper. I got my information from newspapers.com, the Minneapolis Star. The exact paper was from July 28th, 1972. StarTribune.com, Fox9.com, RCFP.org, and MinPost.com. So Virginia grew up in Wayzata. In the Wayzata area, which I think is in Minnesota because they didn't say a different state. She was one of five daughters of Mr. and Mrs. Addison Lewis. And Addison is the husband's name. They did not tell me the wife's name, which made me upset. Her father founded one of the first advertising agencies in Minneapolis. They said the name of it, and then they said, like, the name has changed since, and I was like, I don't care. That just means they have money, obviously. She graduated from Wayzata High School and Pine Manor Junior College, where she had a music scholarship for her violin skills. Her friends described her as an attractive woman who had been active in civic affairs. Her friend said, quote, she is a beautiful person. One of her main interests was the Northwestern Hospital, where she served for five consecutive one-year terms through 1968 as chairman of the Board of Trustees. So there was a pause. I had to breathe.
It's like
a socialite. Mm-hmm. She had also been active in the Wayzata Community Church, the Hennepin County Republican Workshop, the Women's Association of Minnesota Orchestra and Friends of the Institute, which is like the Minneapolis Institute of Art or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or like that's what they changed the name to. Mm-hmm. I don't know. She was a slim woman with silver white hair who acquired a reputation as one of the best dressed women in the Twin Cities area.
I assume this is when she was older that she had silver white hair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wasn't born that way.
No, this is like her description. Like, yeah.
As yeah.
So she also had three sons, Harry, Addison, and David. On July 27th, 1972, Virginia Piper was trimming pansies at her...
Lightyard?
Lake House in Orano when housekeepers alerted her to two masked men entering the home with guns in both of their hands. They tied up the two cleaners, handcuffed 49-year-old Virginia, and asked her where her, quote, old man, her husband, Harry Piper Jr., was. She told them he was at the office, and one of them said, quote, okay, Mrs. Piper, you're coming with us. They handed her one of her own pillowcases, which, like, I guess they got it from one of the housekeepers or something, because I don't think they, like, searched the house, but I guess they could have if they, I don't know, maybe they were looking for Harry first.
No idea.
But anyway, so they handed her one of her own pillowcases and ordered her to cover her head and lie down in the back seat of a green coupe. So before driving off, they left a typed ransom note addressed to, quote, family for $1 million in unmarked bills to be delivered according to precise and non-negotiable instructions the next evening. This was the most expensive demand the FBI had ever seen to this point.
So it was her husband who did it, right?
We're getting there. So Virginia's husband was Harry C. Piper Jr. He was board chairman of the brokerage firm of Piper, Jaffrey, and Hopwood Incorporated. He was a big figure in the community, and he was a respected figure on Wall Street. So, like, these people have a lot of money. So
but
the next
if you're
day,
in Wall Street, you're also prone to losing a lot of money.
That's true.
She shook her head really, really big.
But he lives in Minnesota, so I don't know how often he goes there. And I think he's a lawyer. No, his son's a lawyer. Never mind. So the next day, this was a really hard story to cover because there's not a lot on it. Which is weird. Like, there is and there isn't. There's not detail. Like, you should see the Wikipedia.
It's like really, really, it's an exciting story, but...
Yeah. It's hard. It's hard. Which, like, we'll get to the end and you'll see why. So the next day, Harry came up with 50,000 $20 bills stuffed into a canvas duffel bag weighing 110 pounds.
Where did he get that much money?
He's rich.
What bank had that much money?
Maybe he went to a few. Or they had a safe.
in the house. He just personally kept that much money in his home.
Which is strange for the 70s, but
the fact that it's the next day that he managed to come up with that much money, unless the federal government came and dropped it off as his help to help them with the negotiations, ridiculous.
So he drove alone and without surveillance. He drove into Minneapolis, where a note directed him to a dark parking lot behind a seedy bar in the shadow of downtown. It took him around 2 hours to follow all of the notes, but he left the ransom money in a car trunk behind the Sportsman's Retreat Bar north of downtown Minneapolis.
We had to do, like, an escape room.
Basically. Which, like, that's another thing is I'm like, where was he finding all the different notes? Like, they don't tell you that. Like, they don't tell you so much.
It's really weird that they didn't, like, here's the track he went on.
Because it took him, like, 2 hours, which, like, I don't think it takes 2 hours to get from their house to downtown Minneapolis.
No, but if you
But I don't know where they live, actually. So he returned home after midnight and waited. Around 1 p.m. on Saturday, 48 hours into her abduction, Virginia heard a car door slam and yelled out for help. The kidnappers had revealed her location to a Plymouth pastor, like, anonymously, who called the FBI. Five agents came, quote, running through the underbrush, and she told report that she, that's what she told reporters the next day. Quote, I've never been so glad to see people as I was to see them, is what Virginia said. She was wet from the rain, hungry, exhausted, and traumatized, but physically unharmed. They found her chained to a tree near Jay Cook State Park, southwest of Duluth. Oh, okay,
that makes more sense, because she was in... That makes any more sense that they were coming from the underbrush.
She was immediately flown back to the Twin Cities, where she was reunited with her family
and friends. Where's... Oh, Duluth. Okay, that's not that far.
No. So the oldest of her three sons, Harry, said in a recent email, quote, my mother was a very special and very brave woman who probably saved her own life by engaging her captors in conversation. I now know that the FBI at the time assumed she would be killed. Which, like, that's a normal assumption, especially for
experience.
For rich kidnapping. Yeah. They're like, I'm going to get the money and kill a person because I hate the rich.
Uh-huh.
So, who kidnapped her? So, the FBI had more than 400 suspects. I think they literally interviewed over, like, 1,000 people for this case. But eventually, two men, Don Larson and Ken Callahan, were convicted for her kidnapping in 1977. But the verdict was overturned on appeal because a defense witness wasn't allowed to testify. They were also charged with this crime 5 days before the 5-year statute of limitations expired. One source said that it was 16 days, but anyway, they're like really close to their limit here. So if that doesn't raise red flags, they were acquitted in a second trial, which the FBI's, the FBI, who you can't trust, says like, oh, they were wrong. They should have convicted him. So Don was an unemployed truck driver from South Minneapolis, who had moved to Willow River in 1973 before he was publicly identified as a suspect in the kidnapping. Mm-hmm. And after this, like, the whole trial, the case was closed. So one of the men on the FBI's list was Wild Bill Cooper, who was a drug smuggler who ran the Squirrel Cage Bar in Willow River. He jumped bail and vanished before he was reportedly about to tell the FBI where the ransom money was buried in exchange for his freedom. Some believe he was their third accomplice. There were two pieces of physical evidence found in this case. Larson's alleged fingerprint on a scrap of paper found in the woods near Virginia, and a single hair belonging to the other suspect, Kenneth James Callahan. There was conflicting information here, though, where some sources said the partial fingerprint was found on a grocery bag in the green Monte Carlo that they kidnapped her in, but... So I'm not really sure. Like I said, it's like really, it was hard to find any information on this case. Yeah. Crime writer William Swanson, who wrote Stolen from the Garden, said, quote, many persons familiar with the case believe that the job was too sophisticated for the likes of Callahan and Larson. They were described as minor career criminals. So, Callahan suffered a fatal heart attack at the age of 79 in 2004 after working for years as a carpenter in Cumberland, Wisconsin, and Larson died at 82 in 2008 at the state prison in Oak Park Heights. He was Minnesota's oldest prisoner at the time, and he was serving a life sentence for killing his wife, Ruth, her lover, who was also his best friend, Jim Falco, and three children, including his own 5-year-old son, in rural Pine County 4 years after Virginia's abduction. I don't know who the other kids were. They did not tell me. So the officer who arrived on this scene, not the kidnapping scene, on this murder scene said, when he entered the home, he found Ruth with her dead son wrapped around her legs, still holding a pack of Juicy Fruit gum. No. He found Jim in the garage, who was still alive at the time, and grabbed a tape recorder and took his statement because they knew he was dying. I don't think they really didn't think he was going to make it.
Yeah. So that was smart of him, at least.
And this is what Jim said, quote, "It's a jealous thing. He just got all mad." Larson had apparently come home to find Ruth moving out and his best friend stealing some of his tools, and it was said that he just lost it. Three other kids escaped when Larson ran out of ammo, so, like, I don't know, was she running a daycare or something?
Yeah, why are there so many kids there?
Because that's six kids.
Unless they all just think that's the hangout house.
Like, they only said it was, he only killed, one of the kids was his own. They didn't say all of, like, they didn't say all of their kids. I don't know who these kids are, which this is confusing to me, but. So the officer doubted it was just a domestic. Apparently, Don had brought two cans of gasoline, two handguns, and extra ammo. Two FBI agents arrived at the scene the next morning. He asked what the FBI was doing there, and they said, quote, "This is one of our chief suspects in the Virginia Piper kidnapping."
Huh.
They told him, this was still before the trial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's what I was like, I know it was before the trial, because they say something on later on. So they told him that they had been there last week asking Ruth if, this is the FBI telling this officer, asking Ruth if she was willing to talk to them about the Piper kidnapping. She was Don's alibi 4 years earlier, but had told the police that she had a change of heart and had information for them, but needed to wait until she moved out of their home before she could, you know, tell them. The officer asked if anybody else was there when this conversation took place, and they said, yes, the 5-year-old son. So, it was believed that Ruth possibly wrote the ransom notes, and because the writing didn't match Don or Callahan. So, it was said that Don had picked up his son a couple of days earlier, and the officer believes that the child told his father that Ruth was talking to the FBI. And not necessarily, like, talking to the FBI, but, like, these men were at our house the other day, you know, like, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So detectives had also learned that Don had told a former boss that he buried some money in his yard in Willow River and put a rock on top of it, but he had said that the money disappeared and he suspected that Jim had taken it. Also, only about $4,000 worth of the ransom's $20 bills ever turned up at any banks in Owatonna, Rochester, Austin, Casson, and Dodge Center. So that leaves 996 million.
Right? Thousand.
Did I say that wrong? What am I saying?
996,000.
Yeah.
Millions, a whole nother level of big.
What am I on? Anyway, that leaves nearly a whole $1 million still missing from this case. So Don had told other people that he thought Jim was an FBI informant. The FBI got a search warrant and dug up the 40-acre property, but found nothing. After that, which, like, he said that it was gone.
Yeah.
So I don't know why you... Like, you wouldn't be telling your boss or, like, a friend, be like, Jim stole my $1 million, and then, like, be lying that it's still in your yard? Because why would you tell them where it is if it's still there? Anyway, after the murders, Don fled to Minneapolis, where police arrested him 3 days later at the Fair Oaks Motor Hotel.
How would you flee to a city?
I don't know. A maid had discovered him passed out on the floor from pills and vodka and called the police, so he's probably drunk and high by the time he got there anyway. So, Virginia Piper was convinced Don was one of her kidnappers. There's no more on that, which I don't like. Why is there no direct quotes of her being like, I heard his voice and then heard his voice at the trial, this, that, the other thing. Like, he looks like one of them. His hands look similar. Like, nothing. Don was known as the Mouth in prison because he was such a big talker, aka he had such a big mouth. And always said that he may be a killer, but denied any involvement in the Piper kidnapping. Which, it's like, if you're going to be admitting to your murders, like, why wouldn't you admit to the kidnapping? You're already in jail for life. So, Virginia died in 1988 from pancreatic cancer at age 65. So, you know, we can't get any more info from her or the two men accused. In 2004, Harry, the oldest son, filed a case to gain access to FBI files about his mother's case. He sued the FBI in 1998 after they denied a Freedom of Information Act request for documents related to the kidnapping. He also wanted the hair sample to be analyzed, but he found out the FBI destroyed it.
Because they got some of that money.
Many of the documents that Harry wanted no longer exist.
I still think his father did it.
The court ruled that the FBI must replace picture, must release pictures of an alleged government documented fingerprint. I don't know if they ever did. So apparently.
Doctored?
Oh, alleged government doctored fingerprint.
That changes meanings greatly, so I wanted to make sure.
But that's also the only place that said it was allegedly doctored, so I'm like, I don't know. Like, if the only two pieces of actual physical evidence you have is the hair and the fingerprint, why would those be made up? Wouldn't you have planted more?
Or not something? Not if you have the FBI on your side and you can just tell them, make them be the culprits.
But anyway, so everybody just assumes that there's some kind of cover-up going on.
There's obviously some form of cover-up going on since they're not releasing the documents.
Harry received all but six of the 22 documents that the court ordered released to him, but almost every page had information blacked out. The case is still unsolved and is known as, quote, the nation's most successful kidnapping. And that's the story of Virginia Piper.
What a frustrating story.
And we'll literally never know because the evidence is destroyed.
That, much like Lindbergh.
I mean, the husband might have done it, but at the same time, like, I don't think she got divorced from him or anything. And
yeah, but if it was something about
money.
But
also, what is it?
Then it may not have been. It's like, listen, he didn't kill her.
No.
But if he's, like, paying off debts or doing something else.
That could be.
I assume, especially when he was able to procure that much money at once, because again, banks don't carry that much
money. It definitely seems like there's some kind of weird cover-up going on, but at the same time, it's happening. Like nothing big happened, or like I said, it's all been erased. I can't find anything.
That's like a prime example of something is messed up.
You know, and I like that their oldest son, Harry, too, is still trying to figure out
what happened.
He knows
whatever happened isn't right.
So that's all I've got, unfortunately. There's other stuff about, you know, the FBI documents, like this, that, the other thing, but, like, nothing. There's nothing. This is basically your best.
And I'm only willing to cover conspiracy theories so much.
Well, because they were saying, like, there were documents that he wanted and knew about, but the FBI was like, no, they've all been erased or deleted. And he was like, I know you still have files of them. And the court was like, they searched enough to find the missing documents, so they don't have to reprint out anything. That's what the court ruled. I was looking and trying to find more, but there was hardly anything. And like I said, the Wikipedia page is like, this person got kidnapped from her yard.
Yeah.
They got 1 million. End of story. And I was like, what? Like, there's really nobody that has anything on this case?
It's just wild.
Let's get on to yours. I have to make an apple pie. But yeah, it's frustrating.
It is.
And it was frustrating to research because I was like, no one's telling me anything.
So little on it, even though
there
should
definitely be more. But I'm like, why is there no more about, like, does nobody have any account from Virginia of what actually happened in all of those days? Or is she also just covering it up?
Have you ever covered Lindbergh Baby, or is that just something that everyone else under the sun has covered?
We don't cover it.
Sometimes I want to cover Lindbergh
Baby.
No,
I just talk about how he's a Nazi.
Man, like, I want to go over those things. Less about Lindbergh Baby,
you
more about
Lindbergh
that. Being messed up.
Let's do it. I love bringing down All the Mighty Will Fall. Walt Disney, Charles Lindbergh, who else?
Most old-timey white people.
Yeah. But we also find some pretty cool ones who are very different thinking, I feel like.
Yeah, but those are the ones that we know about and have monuments of and have streets named after.
Yeah.
I think we do a pretty good job of when we find really cool people to cover. Yeah. We cover our really cool people.
And like we always say, we don't. They could have done bad stuff, sure, but for the most part,
in the grand scheme of things, they really did this good. It's like I look for the bad things they've done. I'm not trying to like.
Oh, you do.
Watch. I was like, there has to be a conspiracy theory here, right? Like, there has to be a terrible thing.
I should throw priests in there. I was talking about bad priests.
Anywho. I'm going to talk about the Wabash Street Caves. My sources are Wikipedia, stpaulhistorical.com, historictwincities.com, news.minnesota.publicradio.com, mndaily, fox9.com, and care11.com. There's always radio stations covering these wild things. So the Wabash Street Caves.
There's always radio stations
coming.
I know. I'm like, what is up with that?
So the Wabash Street Caves were originally part of a mining network. So this means they're all man-made. These are not naturally occurring caves. It doesn't mean there weren't naturally occurring rock shelters in the area. That seems to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's like, so this is called caves, but really it's a mining complex. These are located, I think, they're at least on the south shore of the Mississippi River in downtown St. Paul, Minnesota. They could totally be on the other side, too, because I assume there's rock formations on both sides that allows for this mining. Because they were mining St. Peter's Formation sand, which is, like, one of the best quality sands for silica production. So, like, silica is used for a whole bunch of things, like glass and stuff.
Yeah.
So that's what they're mining here is sand. So the mining activity started in the 1840s. And continued for a while. I think it, like, petered off in, like, the late 1800s, maybe early 1900s. No one seemed to care. It was not in any records.
Yeah.
I'm sure I could have found it if I looked, but I also didn't care. So, after the mining was abandoned, this new cave system that had been created was used for a whole bunch of different things. It was used for mushroom growing, it was used, as storage for all kinds of things, food, random objects.
Natural fridge.
A nice natural fridge. It's not a natural dance hall. Well, yeah, I mean, it's using nature as a fridge, even though it's a man-made space.
Yes.
So it is said that the caves were also used as trash dumps for flood debris whenever the Mississippi flooded. I don't think that was ever, like, in an official capacity, but, like, if you happen to live near one of the many, many openings and there is a bunch of gross things that flooded into whatever space you were in charge of. Shove it in the hole.
You know what's funny? Why didn't people think when they started building modern houses, if you dig down far enough, you can just have a fridge without ever having to get an electrical fridge? What if every house just had, like, a cool dungeon-y...
That'd be awesome.
...fridge?
Like those wine cellars that, cool? that are down the spiral staircase?
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, it'd be awesome.
I mean, everybody now, since they're so lazy, they would say how much of an inconvenience it is, but I'd be like, we are saving money on electricity.
I'd use the heck out of that.
I know.
Here's the thing. It would really, one, more exercise because you're doing all those stairs.
Yes.
Two, you can't just go stand in the fridge all the time because it's, like, conveniently located to do boredom eating.
Less snacking.
Yeah, less snacking. You only get food then when you actually need the food.
Or if you're really motivated to go down those stairs, which I would be.
Go down the stairs, eat 5 grapes. Wait, I wanted more grapes. Go down the stairs, eat 5 more grapes. Wait, I wanted more grapes. Go down the stairs, grab all of the grapes.
Well, it's like, and then if you had that, you could still have some kind of, like, mini fridge upstairs for the things that you need it more to. I just think that'd be cool. Anyway, I'm on to something. Always
I think it'd be a good idea. It seems like it should be green.
It seems earth-saving.
It seems like it should be.
But you need to do it in a way you're not making sinkholes. Okay, people?
Yeah, watch out if you're in a cave state. Missouri, cave state number 3.
There's a bunch of missing people here, and they're all by the caves.
Yep.
Not all of them, but, like, a
lot of them. Sinkholes are dangerous, guys. Keep a tracking device on you at all times.
Yeah. Keep your Apple Watch on.
But
then it's also, like, can that even, if you're down in one of those, can it still track you?
I feel like if you were over the
location where
you were
missing. You need to have one of those, like, special dog collars for those dogs that, like, run into the woods. With how expensive I've seen some of them to be, because this is when Opry ran away that one time, and I really thought that she was...
I better be able to track him for her
two states
over. I
really thought she was going to be a runner.
Yeah.
I was looking into all this stuff. We ended up just getting the Apple AirTag, but...
Mm-hmm.
I looked into, like, there's one that starts with an F. That's been, like, a pretty popular one. And they're really expensive.
Yeah, I see that one all the time.
That's why I'm like, with how expensive they are,
better be able to, like, from Minnesota to here,
literally,
better be able to find them.
Ping it off all the towers.
Bing, bing, bing. So other businesses along this section of bluff carved into the sandstone included Yurd's Brewery that made... cave-aged beer. That was their, like, claim to fame, is their beer was cave-aged. There's a whole bunch of other businesses. That was the only one worth mentioning.
That's funny.
In the 1920s, the caves, which were previously being used by Albert Muchnot? I don't know. To grow mushrooms, were turned into a restaurant/club called the Wabasha Speakeasy. A dining room was carved to accommodate the restaurant, and a grandstand was installed. So, like, they were like, there's caves here, we're gonna expand. Yeah. So they, like, pinned it into the cave. Like, they carved out more sand. Which I think is really fun that you can just make the spaces whatever you need them to be by carving into the walls. Which makes me wonder how many times, like, you accidentally carve slightly too far over and now you're in, like, someone else's storage room or something. Whoops!
Oh, sorry. Fill that hole in a second.
And put a door there.
Yeah.
On October 26th, 1933, Josie and William Lehman opened the Castle Royale, which was built into the side of the rock face, so, like, it had, like, an exterior, like, castle-esque, like, German-looking Fachwerk style. What's the common English word for that? Like Queen Anne?
I don't know.
No, not Queen Anne. Tudor? I think it's Tudor. But it's like that, you know, like the white plaster on the outside with the dark wood lines.
Yeah. I think that's right.
I don't know. Anyway, so they make like a cool building like that on the outside of where the speakeasy used to be and then made it into a new venue.
Yeah, that's correct.
They added elegant chandeliers, lavish oriental rugs, a gambling room in the back. So, like, a cool, fun place to be because it was a cave, too. And, like, that was obviously used in the advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was doing well until the late 1930s, just before the U.S. joined World War II. And that's when it closed its doors for, I assume there are some economic reasons happening that it got closed. Local legends say the gangsters like John Dillinger, Alvin Creepy,
oh,
Carrips.
Gotta cover him.
I told you there were some fun gangsters in the area.
Fred, I know, but Arthur, I knew I would go too in depth and it would be too long. It overwhelmed me from yesterday.
Fred and Arthur, Doc Baker, Babyface Nelson, and me Ma too. Baker were all said to frequent the Castle Royale and the Speakeasy. They were just whatever business was in this location they went to, apparently. Of course, there's no real record of that, but people love to say that so and so that's really cool has been in this space.
I wish we still had gangsters like that, not right? Like just the like ruffians we have these days. Because they used to be cool.
Well, they used
and
to
you
be.
And you were scared of them, but you respected them.
There was also a sense of security that they would give you, as long as you like were following their rules, there nothing else would happen. And that's like that's a good state of mind to be in a lot of times, especially if you're in like rougher areas. According to local legend, this is my favorite part. There, in the fireside room, were four gangsters who were playing cards in the Castle Royale when a man walked in with a case in his hand and asked the band to leave. The band and most of the staff complied. Actually, all the staff. The only people who were left in there was the guy with the case.
Gangsters.
And then four gangsters. And then a waitress, who I think was like the last one through a door, reported hearing the pops of a Thompson submachine gun, which is wild to me because they're the worst guns to ever have been made.
They're so inaccurate.
Not only that, they don't fire correctly most of the time, especially if you have the round ammo cartridges on them. Yeah. They like clog constantly. So maybe that's how she knew it was a Thompson. Because
it wasn't even firing.
Stuttering. Yeah. She went back into the room and found three men dead. The fourth card player and the man with the case were no longer in the room. We don't know where they went. Probably deeper into the caves.
Yeah.
Because they, like, crisscross maze every which way. The waitress called the police and waited outside for them. When they arrived, the police accused her of lying as they found no bodies, no blood, and nothing else to show the crime had occurred. All that were left were bullet holes in the wall in the fireplace.
Men.
Which they were like, those could have been there already.
They could have been there already, buddy.
Which is actually ridiculous. They should have looked like it was recently broken off. Like, there's wear that happens.
The gangsters aren't paying them.
No,
I know. Or it was a cop who went in.
But what I'm saying is, you could have proven that it was in the last X amount of time because they're smoking in this space. So it's going to very, very quickly yellow, right? Mm-hmm. So if these are fresh, you know, white bullet hole marks in the stone, obviously they happened recently. Anywho.
Can't trust the popo.
So it said that the bodies of these three men were buried somewhere in the cave, either by the killers, the staff that was still in there, or the police. The point is, obviously, other people were in on it.
There's bodies in here somewhere.
And this is, like, such a legend that it's not in the newspapers. Like, this is legend.
Yeah.
But it's a fun one. And it's entirely possible.
And I believe it.
Because
if gangsters frequent it, you know there's got to be back ways out of it.
Oh, yeah.
Things like that. It's speakeasy. You know? So.
And the bullet holes are apparently still visible in the fireplace. And I'm thinking, like, if this story is not real, someone made a fun story to go with the bullet holes that are in the fireplace, which is not a common thing to happen in tourist destinations.
But it's a very good explanation for
it's a really fun
it's
one.
It's not, like, a outlandish, like, that would literally never happen.
No, it's a reasonable one for the time frame. So after the Castle Royale closed, the space that it was in was once again used to grow mushrooms. And St. Paul, for a time between the 1880s and the 1980s, so the 1880s is when I think they stopped mining because it becomes the mushroom capital of the Midwest because they grew so many mushrooms in these caves. It was really, really good for it, apparently. That's a fun thing. I think St. Paul should really lean into that, tourism-wise.
Come check out our mushrooms.
Just mushroom-themed everything. Mushrooms are in right now.
They should do a mushroom theme park. How cute would that be?
They should have a mushroom festival.
It would be a fairyland.
St. Paul's missing out.
Let's pitch this to somebody.
Yeah.
Take our idea.
So in the 1970s, the Castle Royale 2 was opened, and it was a disco venue this time.
Oh, boy.
Also, we're going back in time briefly. In the 1930s, a professor, like, from one of the local universities realized that the conditions in the caves were really similar to those of the Roquefort Caves in France, which is Roquefort is where they make a lot of blue cheese and other specialty cheeses. So he's like, I bet you we can make blue cheese in these caves. And for a while, it was not catching on. Like, people were like, why would I want to buy Minnesota
blue cheese?
I don't
want your cave cheese.
I don't want to, no, I mean, they want the cave cheese from France, not the cave cheese from Minnesota.
Well, yeah, I don't want your Midwest cave cheese.
Yeah, they didn't want the Midwest
Get
cave
out of
cheese.
Here.
Until World War II started. And then all the blue cheese imports from France basically stopped for obvious reasons.
Wow.
So in the year of 1941, this just the year 1941, St. Paul produced 3 million pounds of blue cheese.
Hey, it's not just Wisconsin.
And so for a time after this started happening, Lando Lakes either rented or purchased the location of the Castle Royale was and turned it into their cheese caves that they used from 1940 to 1959, when I assume they got a better refrigeration system somewhere else. But so for a while, these caves were just cheese and mushrooms.
That's hilarious.
They said, we can be fancy here with our fake caves. I think it's so. These, like, I kept finding the weirdest things out about these caves, and it got to the point where it's like, you know, maybe there's 1.5 ghosts here, and I don't even care anymore because these are just really weird.
Good fun facts.
So currently, the section of caves where Castle Royale is located offers a bunch of different kinds of tours, history, ghosts, anything in between those two things. I think they have, like, a dinner theater tour with, like, gangsters or something. Mm-hmm. They have a whole bunch of different options. And they also have swing dance nights. And it can be rented for events and weddings, but it's not, like, a consistently open restaurant anymore.
Dang.
I think it's, like, pretty consistently open.
Yeah.
It's just not specifically a restaurant. So a number of people have died in the caves.
Dun, dun, dun.
Other than
the legend.
The legend of the three card players. So in 2004, a teenager was rescued from the caves after three of his friends died from apparent carbon monoxide asphyxiation.
Oh, gotta have those little Tweety birds.
Truly.
And Finley. I think Finley would also be
I'll get to what they think the explanation of that was. So 2004, teenager was rescued, three of his friends died from apparent carbon monoxide asphyxiation. The teens' bodies were found about 600 feet into the cave. And the source of the carbon monoxide is not specifically known, but people do like to start fires in there. And since there's no airflow naturally, the fire consumes the oxygen and creates carbon monoxide in that space.
Yeah.
And it'll just sit right
there
in these pockets. And if you get caught in one of these pockets, especially if it's a bigger pocket, you die.
Dead.
So the Tina said he briefly lost consciousness. He woke again and desperately searched for a way out, but it's like, it's dark, he's in a cave. He noticed a pinprick of light a distance away and followed it and was just, like, freaking lucky he got out because he was in, like, critical condition. And this is not the first time this has happened. These teens would have grown up with knowing the story about how in 1992, two other teenagers had succumbed to a similar fate. And this is, like, a common, like, this is why you don't go in the caves, children.
Yeah.
Well, they became another one of those stories. And then since 1988, three other people have died in the caves, one from drowning. Still have no idea how that happened. I tried to figure that out. I assume, like, during a flood, they were in there.
Yeah.
Like, they might have been living in there, taking shelter in there, and then it flooded, and then they drowned. One from a fire, and I don't know if that means they caught on fire or if they suffocated as well. And then one from a cave-in.
Scary.
So authorities have made efforts to close off the caves, but not all the entrances are known. And you can make new entrances if you want.
Yeah.
Because it's sandstone. Pretty easy. And then in 2017, two more people were rescued from the cave after being stuck at the base of a bluff after entering the cave through a tube-like opening. I have no clue how this worked out, but I think it's like a weird open entrance to the cave that's like lower down on the bluffs and where the rest of these are. And they wanted to like go explore that route. And then they got stuck because one of their friends didn't want to go in and then was like, oh, well, they should be back by now. They're not back by now. So they called authorities and it took 2.5 hours to get them out. They didn't
I would
die.
Be the friend that didn't go in.
Right? I'll always be the friend that doesn't go in. Because then you can be a hero.
Don't fall to peer pressure.
So currently the Wabash Street Caves offer a Lost Souls tour, amongst other ones. This is their ghost one, though. Mm-hmm. And they've commented that, curiously, ghostly activity just happens to increase, be at its height, be at its most, during the month of October, just casually.
Oh, I wonder why.
Uh-huh. I didn't like that explanation. And that's when I got nervous that nothing else would be very fun.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, no, they're making it up. Like, they're making up all the gangster stories. But then I got a whole bunch of, like, fun ones. And some of them are, like, older, which is really cool.
Hmm.
So strange whistling and unexplained footsteps are common. And I think that's also very easily explained away because
cave noises.
There are other people in the caves.
Yeah.
We know there are other people in the caves. We have lots of stories of people dying in the caves. And it's not like those are the only people going in. Those are the ones that are unlucky.
Yeah.
And it's attached to other businesses that are still using the caves.
Yeah.
So that's not great paranormal evidence, in my opinion. They also hear stones being tossed. Again, one, either it's a cave, stones fall. Especially since it's a mined-out cave, not a naturally forming one, so it doesn't have the same structure.
Or somebody kicked it
again,
and didn't notice.
Yeah, someone kicked it, because it'll be on tours when they're hearing that. Or, again, other people are in the caves.
Yeah.
And animals are in the caves.
Mm-hmm.
Now we'll get to more of the ghosts, the less explainable ones. So sightings of one of the card players has been recorded glaring at visitors before walking past them through a cave wall, which I think is really, really weird. Because it's, like, pretty universally accepted that a ghost walking through a wall is because of, a changed floor plan, which also could just be nonsense, but, like, that's the general consensus. And we know that the cave walls haven't shifted, because that's not how caves work.
Uh-huh.
So it's weird to me that that's part of this story.
I don't know. I've never necessarily thought it because they're walking through their old floor plan, because I don't feel like every ghost is stuck in their past.
That's what I'm thinking,
know?
Too. I'm thinking some of them might be on a loop and walking through the wall repeatedly might be because the floor plan was different, but I think if they're not on a loop,
they can do whatever.
They can just mess with you and walk through the walls. I'd be like, ha ha ha, because if I was a ghost, I'd walk through the walls to mess with people.
I'd just be like sticking my head out.
So in the 1970s, this is one of the old ones, it's fun. In the 1970s, musicians reported their equipment would fly off the stage with no explanation, and I really like that. Some have seen a...
See, that's one of those hauntings that would just piss you off and not scary. I'd be like, I swear to God, if you do that one more
that's
time...
That's so expensive, can you not?
We're trying to set up for the disco.
So some have seen a spooky woman sitting
me?
At the
they
bar. And I don't know what that means and why they think she's a ghost, but that was all I got.
But she probably has, like, those gaunt cheeks and,
yeah,
you know, that
like
kind
that.
Of thing. Just an old person.
Others have seen an apparition of a man sitting in the audience near the main stage. And I assume that means where there's not supposed to be. Like, they don't mean there's an audience of people. Yeah, they mean it's in the audience space. They look out
and there's, yeah.
Which is like a common theater haunting. Others have also seen a man sitting somewhere in the vicinity wearing a Panama hat, who's like a different one than the other ones we've mentioned so far.
Yeah.
I like that specific description.
Yeah.
There's also said to be a photo somewhere in existence of a boy sitting at a table smiling at a number of misty forms who were sitting around the table with him at a wedding event. And that's fun. I didn't bother to see if, like, I could find it.
Yeah.
But that was one of, like, the cool paranormal things about the caves.
Interesting.
And then the last one is that there was a boy who was playing with the ball and dropped the ball, and it would, like, bounced, rolled into the men's room. And when he went in there, he encountered a man in classic gangster attire. And, like, you know, he looked up and was like, oh, strange man. Sorry to interrupt you in the men's room. You're my ball. And you're wearing odd clothes. And the gangster ghost straightened his tie, turned and smiled at the boy, winked, and vanished.
Goals. That's the kind of ghost I'm trying to see. Like, right? Come on.
Who's, like, interacting with me in a positive way, but no way, like, scaring me.
That's great.
So that is the Wabasha Street Caves.
Very interesting. I've never heard of them, like,
ever. I hadn't either. And I was shocked that I got, one, so much weird history, and two, multiple specific little ghost hauntings.
Yeah.
I was pleasantly delighted by the Wabasha Street Caves.
That's pretty good. I like that. I like gangster ghosts.
They're, I love so gangster ghosts. I feel like gangster ghosts like being gangster ghosts, too.
They do.
They always seem to be having a good time.
Them and their Tommy guns. Okay, well, that's it for this week, I guess. Try not to kill anybody and don't mess with Ouija boards. Bye.